Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Take two East Coast society women, both single, throw them into the wilds of northwestern Colorado in 1916 to teach the kids there, and chances are you'll get a pretty decent story. Those ingredients are the underpinnings of Dorothy Wickenden's bestseller, Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West. One of those women was Dorothy's grandmother, and yes, this story begins with the rediscovery of long-forgotten letters describing a very different time and place. Later on this hour, we'll talk about the art of writing historical fiction, which is something very different from what Dorothy Wickenden accomplished in Nothing Daunted. Dorothy Wickenden has been the executive editor of The New Yorker since 1996. She speaks at the Central Exchange this morning and at Unity Temple on the Plaza tonight. More on both of those events in just a few minutes. Dorothy, so good to have you here. Welcome to Kansas City.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Well, if I understand correctly, this book might not have happened save for a broken ankle.
That's exactly right. And I've become less embarrassed to tell this story as time has gone on.
Because you've had to tell it over and over and over again.
Yeah. It did. I was running down the stairs one day, tripped and fell, broke my ankle, and was laid up with it for 2 weeks. And I decided to clean out my desk drawer. And way at the back, I squeezed in, among other folders, I found one that was labeled Dorothy Woodruff Letters, 1916-17. Mm-hmm. And I suddenly realized what they were. It was a folder my mother had given me 20 years before, and I had two young children, and I had just put it in the back, meaning to read them someday, and had forgotten about it.
Well, as you went through those letters, did you know you had something special on your hands?
Yes, I absolutely did. I've been an editor for so many years, and so I was, and I had enough distance from the story that I was able to read it just as if it were, you know, a set of letters from someone else, except that my grandmother, who was writing them at age 29, just setting out on the adventure of her life, cutting loose from her parents for the first time, wrote with this, you know, unbelievable verve and exuberance. And yet I knew it was my grandmother's voice. It was just unmistakable. And I read all of the letters, and I thought, it's a self-contained story right here. She was a magnificent writer. I had known her growing up as a wonderful storyteller, but the letters really showed me that she knew how to write, and this was a talent she never knew she had.
You know, but your grandmother's letters were really only half the story. How did you come up with the other half?
Well,
because two women went to the
West.
Yes.
So her dear friend, Rosamond Underwood, whom she had met in kindergarten in the late 1800s, they became fast friends. They were friends for 83 years.
My gosh.
So I had written the story first for The New Yorker magazine, where I work, and had just written about my grandmother's letters and really focused on that 1 year teaching school. But I knew for the book I had to find Rosamond's letters, and it took me a year. No one in the family even knew if they had survived. And I threw a grandson, I finally tracked them down to an attic, and they were literally in a rotting attic box in Norwalk, Connecticut, in some friend's house. And I was invited there by Rosamond's grandson, and he said, oh, don't expect to find anything. It's just old family, you know, junk. And there they were. After about 2 hours of hunting, my husband, who was along with me, actually found the first letter, and they were all bundled together very neatly, typed by Rosamond's mother. And the whole set was there, and my story was then complete, at least of the two women.
And if you hadn't found Rose's letters, then Roz's letters, you might not have had a book then, right?
Well, it would have been a much thinner book. My grandmother wrote within enough detail in her letters, and also left a wonderful oral history, which described their whole process of growing up in Auburn, New York, and the very privileged circumstances that they grew up among. So I did have a great story there. And then subsequently, my aunt, my grandmother's older sister, found 40 letters that my grandmother had written home after they had graduated from Smith College, and they were on a grand tour of Europe. And she wrote these letters to all the members of her family. And those were fantastic letters, too. So I probably could have done a book. It just wouldn't have been quite the same. I knew I really wanted Rosamond's voice in there, too.
You know, Dorothy, I guess the million-dollar question here finally is, so why did Dorothy and Roz decide together to go off into the wilds of northwestern Colorado to teach on their own back in 1916. It's just amazing to me.
It's amazing to everyone. And it was amazing even to them when they realized that what they had decided to do. Through a complicated series of events, they heard that a Princeton graduate, also had gone to Harvard Law School, was opening a school for the children of homesteaders in the remote West, on the west side of the Rocky Mountains. And they had been home. They went to Smith College together, came home, didn't want to get married, but were looking for some kind of way to contribute to society and also some kind of adventure. And they just couldn't find it in Auburn. They were ardent suffragists. They tried that. They dabbled in this and that. There just wasn't anything in Auburn. It was a stultifying, you know, sort of upper class existence, and they wanted to do something fun.
And they were kind of gambling, right? Because they were getting a little old in terms of the need to get married at that time and all of those kinds of things.
Oh, absolutely. They were considered in Auburn old maids, and their parents were very upset about it. And when they heard that they had secretly applied for this job, these jobs out in the middle of nowhere, they were horrified. And Auburn society was horrified. Why would they do that? And clearly they were throwing away any chance of marrying a respectable young man by going out into the wilderness.
And so you think they did it ultimately because why?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. They had grown up in Auburn, which was an amazing city. It was mostly conservative, but there was a real sense of radicalism there. William Seward, President Lincoln's Secretary of State, lived there. He hid slaves in the he was a major member of the Underground Railroad. He got Harriet Tubman to move to town. And there were women suffragists for generations who had been very, very active in town. And Dorothy and Roz were inspired by them. And then, of course, when they went to Smith College, there was a real feminist slant to the education they got there. And one of the things the president of the college said to them was, all these women, are you a leaner or a lifter? And it really was expected that even if you went home and got married, you were expected to contribute to society. And they seriously wanted to do something, and they wanted to have a good time, too.
We're visiting with Dorothy Wickenden about her book, Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West. And I should point out, she'll be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To reserve a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Well, describe Dorothy and Roz to us, because as folks might imagine, these were two pretty extraordinary women.
They were remarkable. They had a sense from early on that they really wanted to do something special with their lives. And they were – and I know now from listening to the oral histories and also from reading my grandmother's letters that they were actually quite surprised when they graduated from Smith and almost all of their friends got married and had children right away. They went to the Smith reunion and they just said, this is not for us. So they were just yearning for something, and they thought, well, maybe Europe. Maybe we'll find what we're looking for in Europe. And they didn't know quite what it was, because there were no opportunities for women in that era, even for college-educated women, especially for college-educated women who wanted to do something special with their lives. So they looked and looked and looked, and it was 6 years after they graduated before they found what they were looking for. And it was just kind of a fluke that they heard about this, and it completely changed their lives.
How are they different as individuals?
Quite different. Yeah. The man who brought them out there, who had built this wonderful schoolhouse, Farrington Carpenter. He later described my grandmother as the spark plug of the two. She was 4 feet 11, tiny, weighed about 100 pounds, but had this buoyant, lovely, outgoing disposition and was ready to try anything. And Roz was – they were so close but quite different. Roz was the more stately – she was tall and willowy and lovely. And my grandmother always admired her, and she always said, oh, Rosamond was the belle of Auburn. And so there was no jealousy between the two of them. They just complemented each other perfectly.
So Farrington Carpenter is obviously a key character in this book. He happened to be a Princeton and Harvard law grad himself, very contrary to what you might think for someone out in northwestern Colorado. He was the man who sought out these women. What made him think that a pair of women like Dorothy and Roz would even be interested in something as wild as this?
Well, this was sort of the dramatic crux of the story. And one of the things I wanted to find out was why he decided to go after two women who had no experience teaching at all. There were women in Colorado who had gone to teaching school. And one thing that the sort of secret that my grandmother never let on in all of her stories was that he and his and the cowboys whom he lived with out there there were no young women, and so Ferry dreamed up this idea of this with his neighbors of this
smart
wonderful
man.
School, very very strategically clever man, funny too, and he thought he could kill two birds with one stone. He could get two school teachers to teach these children who would have no school and no teachers otherwise, and then he could bring these cultivated young women, and so in effect import the East, the great virtues of the East, into the wonderful yet to be cultivated West. So they were very excited. He sold it to them as an opportunity to discover the last of the unfenced West, and they were carried away by that romance, not knowing that there was this ulterior motive.
Do you actually have his original solicitation of them anywhere where he describes what he wanted to do?
I do. This was one of the remarkable things I uncovered in that attic box in Norwalk, Connecticut. It was absolutely amazing. I found the original telegram that he had sent them saying, "You are consider yourselves hired." I have letters back and forth with a woman who was kind of the middleman in arranging this. And he said he was an old friend of hers from Evanston, because he had grown up in Evanston, Illinois. And he said, "You know, please check them out. And if you don't think they have the grit and the gumption to do this, let's drop them right away."
Dorothy Wickenden is our guest. If you by chance have read this book, it's just out in paperback now. Give us a phone call. Tell us what you thought of it. Or if you have a question for Dorothy, you can ask that too. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Well, what did Farrington offer them exactly, Dorothy?
He offered them the adventure of their lives. And one of the things he said, too, he said he did make this comment about the unfenced West. And he was a total believer in, you know, that democracy began out West. And he really sold them on that. And then he also said, this is the opportunity to teach these kids everything to them as a 7-day wonder, as he put it. He loved those children. And he thought they deserved, you know, the absolute best education. And that was what he was going to deliver them. And he had this sense that even though these women had no experience, they would bring something to these children that they wouldn't have otherwise. And it was a very lucky match, as it turned out. He became lifelong friends with both of them. They thought he was an absolutely extraordinary man, which he was. And one of the little boys up in Elkhead, which is where he was homesteading and where the school was built, one of the little boys they discovered on the first day of school thought that Farrington Carpenter was the president of the United States.
Is the school still there by any chance?
It is.
You're kidding me.
No, and it's completely intact. And you go up there and it looks almost exactly the way it did then. And he said he had told one of his granddaughters in the 1970s, when he described the building of the school, he had planned it very carefully, he said, along classical lines. And he said, "We built it out of stone, sturdy mountain stone." He said, "You didn't want to build a little shack up there."
Yeah.
He wanted this to be kind of a historical monument of some kind. Always, people described him as a visionary, and he really was.
There was an actual divider in the middle of the school so both women could teach different classes at the same time, right?
Yes.
Describe the school a little more.
Yes, and actually that divider is still in the basement, if you can believe it, a folding wooden door.
That's got to be just amazing, coming across that school when you visited it for the first time seeing it. It must have been just remarkable.
It was really thrilling, and it was the middle of February, because I wanted to see what the winter was like up there, because my grandmother and Roz had described this harsh, harsh winter so vividly. You know, they had to ride horses 2.5 miles each way to school through blizzards almost every day in the middle of the winter, and the children had to ski on old barrel staves. Just, you know, unbelievably harsh conditions. But there was a huge coal stove in the basement, and the children would all warm up before the stove before they could start school, because a lot of the little children would be crying. Their hands and their feet were so cold.
Mm.
So the divider made it, in effect, a two-room schoolhouse. But then they would open up the door for community events, because this was the community center. So it was a church. It was where they had all of their parties, and it was the only place place where the community could get together. And it was a very important thing for all of these people because they were so isolated. And they all lived about 5 miles away from each other. So it was a bit of an event whenever there was a party at the school.
Was there any sign that both of them had actually been there at one point? They hadn't scrawled their names on the bottom of a desk or something like that?
No, I wish. And the desks had – most of the desks had been stolen by the time I got there. There were some of the iron-wrought sides of the desk were still hanging up in the rafters in the basement. But I could see the shadow where the huge blackboards once were, and the beautiful wooden floor that they had described was there. The oak floor was there, and these way oversized windows. And Ferry had said to his granddaughter, you know, we planned the building so that the sun would come over the children's shoulders, and so they, you know, it would light the way, and they would have these beautiful views on every side of the mountains. And it was really kind of an inspirational. The whole thing was just an inspirational idea, and it stayed with the children very much too.
Does the school actually sort of sit by itself out on a hilltop somewhere, or what's the landscape?
Yes,
like?
He chose the site very carefully. It's on the top of the highest mountain out there. So, you know, you would think it was a bit of a folly to do this with this tiny community.
Yeah.
And, you know, it cost $500. They all pooled their money and they built this and he hired local carpenters and so on. And yet, as I discovered when I went back to try to recreate some of this and to find out what effect this school and the first school teachers had on these children, it was just remarkable. All of these families, all the ones I found, had handed down the story through their generations, just as my family had. They remembered Miss Woodruff and Miss Underwood, the grandchildren, very, very vividly, and had wonderful tales to tell.
Where did the two of them live while they were teaching? They were like 2.5 miles away, you said.
Yes. Well, the wonderful Ferry Carpenter not only had found them two horses to ride to school every day, he had found them an extraordinary family to live with called the Harrisons. And so they were boarders, and they paid, you know, a couple of dollars of rent each month. And Mrs. Harrison ended up becoming a very close friend of theirs. She was just the very embodiment of a pioneer woman, but she had this extraordinary sense of humor. She was fascinated by these two women from the East. And my grandmother said, you know, sitting down to dinner was just a wonderful experience. She said, because we all so mutually amuse each other. It was this amazing coming together of two totally different cultures. So they brought their postcards from Europe and all these stories of where they had been.
I was going to say, they must have swept in there like a prairie fire in a sense, just two creatures from another world in a sense.
Yes, and I think the women were a little taken aback when they got there and they saw that they were revered in this community with their education and their travels. And the families just thought, you know, why are you here? Why would you, when you had so many things to choose from, why would you come to teach our children?
Dorothy Wickenden, again, is our guest. Her book, Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West. Again, she speaks at 7 tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza. Call our friends at Renée Books in Fairway to reserve a seat, 913-384-3126. And again, our phone number here to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate at KCUR.org, or again, go to KCUR's Facebook page. So how many kids did they actually wind up teaching?
Well, Dorothy had about 10 students in her class. They divided it by age. Dorothy had the younger children. They were ages 6 to about 13, and then Roz had the older ones. And Roz mostly ended up having girls, and they were very, very well-behaved and very studious. Mm-hmm. And she had 14 to 19. But it was hard teaching these children of various ages, and my grandmother ended up having a class of 10, actually 10 boys and one girl, and these kids were out of control. So not only did she have to learn how to teach, she had to learn how to discipline.
And how did she discipline?
Well, it was pretty tough. In the beginning, she wrote to her father and she said, you know, I'm told, because a teacher had visited her and said, you have to get these children under control. And so she said, I can't possibly, you know, exert harsh discipline on these children. She loved them. And yet it turned out after a couple of months, she ended up being quite strict with them because it was the only way she could figure out how to keep them in their seats and paying attention.
And both of these women were very relieved to find out that they didn't have to teach home ec.
Oh, home ec was a big deal.
Which was just the opposite of what you might expect. But they did not want to teach it, and they didn't want to teach it because why?
Well, it was called domestic science at the time.
Yeah.
And they were terrified of the academics as well, but they kept writing about how are we ever going to teach domestic science, because they grew up in households with many servants, and they were not allowed into the kitchen. And all of their own dresses were handmade by, you know, very good seamstresses in Rochester, New York. And so they had no idea what they were doing. And as it turns out, I couldn't quite tell from the letters, but I'm pretty sure they ended up cooking soup on the basement stove. And all I can imagine is that the older girls taught them how to make soup because they had no idea.
No idea. That's exactly the way I was raised. I can't cook. So many servants everywhere. I just didn't know what
Me
to
too,
do.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah, 816-235-2888, our email address, up to date. @kcur.org. Leslie from Leawood writes us this: I'm so excited that you're talking about Nothing Daunted, because while the women's circumstances are unique of another time, their story is universal in their slow-to-dawn realization of adult responsibility and desire to do something truly worthwhile, truly undaunted, which is the attitude our kids today need to adopt.
Oh, that's a wonderful comment, and I couldn't agree more. And I think that this was one of the things that inspired me and why I decided to write the book right now, because I just feel the 21st century, we're all so – we've lost something essential, and we've lost this – I mean, Ferry Carpenter was essentially a community organizer, a very, very important figure in his community, and he was a catalyst for – and his neighbors – that's why this little boy thought he was the president of the United States. He was a major figure. And was an inspirational one, and he showed these children and these teachers and these parents what these kids were capable of doing, and it was absolutely amazing.
Well, how surprised are you that this book has taken off? I mean, why the appeal? What's drawn readers? What kind of feedback have you gotten from them as you've gotten around a little bit?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I saw my mother the other day, and she was the one who handed me the letters, so she's largely responsible for this book. And she said, why do you think it's been such a success? Because to her, this was just her mother's story, which she heard all – and she knew it was remarkable, but she heard it all the time growing up. And I said, well, I think there is this yearning, just as your emailer just said. I think there is a yearning to recapture – what America has lost. And also we all look back and we see how this country was built. And it was built by these stoic people who most people have forgotten. And I wanted to write about people whom historians largely just overlook because they were, you know, many of these communities have completely vanished. And yet the values that these people held and the work that they did built America.
Yeah. How often did these two women, as they first arrived in northwestern Colorado, think to themselves, what on earth have we gotten ourselves into here?
Well, there isn't much evidence in the letters, and certainly not when my grandmother told the stories, that was the major response they had. There are a couple of letters where my grandmother sounds sort of homesick, and, you know, in the middle of the winter, I think it got really pretty hard. She had gotten engaged on the way out, so she missed her fiancé. Rosamond was being ardently wooed by both Ferry Carpenter and Ferry Carpenter's best friend. So I think Roz was having quite a great time despite the weather. But they did, and there were times when they felt a little bit overwhelmed and they really had to prepare for class. But they had this sense of freedom out there that they couldn't possibly ever have had in Auburn. And they met all of these pioneering families. And they thought they were absolutely extraordinary. And so this is what my grandmother talked about when I saw her. She talked about Auburn, too, but it really was this 9 months in the West that changed her and Rosamond forever. Rosamond told her grandchildren, that was the best year of my life.
How long did they stay?
Just 9 months for that one school year.
How often do they come back?
Well, people will have to read the book, but one of them settled out there, and then the other came back for occasional visits. My grandmother said that they probably both would have stayed on for another year if circumstances had been different, because it really, they loved the teaching in the end.
What kind of protection did Farrington Carpenter offer the two of them? Because again, just to stick two single women out in the mountains of northwestern Colorado, what did he give them to give them some sense of security out there?
Well, he gave them the Harrisons, and he was so shrewd. At one point, he wrote a letter saying, would you rather live in a cabin by yourself or live with a family? And when you think, I mean, that would have been a disaster. So, but the Mrs. Harrison and Mr. Harrison and the children in the house regarded these women as frail, but, you know, wonderful people who had come to donate something to their community and really, really took care of them. And then Ferry himself kept a very close eye on the classroom. And he must have figured out that they couldn't do very well in the domestic science department. So he went up one day and he showed them how to cook some cornbread. Or he'd teach a class in Tennyson. Mm-hmm. Just a very well-read, very unusual personality.
Did they carry guns? Because I think they bought one on the way
Well,
out,
and
right?
This was kind of a joke. The last letter he sent to them before they left Auburn, he said, "Well, you might want to bring a 22 out here. Yes. It's open season on sage chickens."
Yeah.
And so they, not knowing his sense of humor at that mm-hmm. point, they thought, "Well, I guess we better get a rifle." So when they stopped in Chicago on their way out to stay with Rosamond's uncle,
they liked to shop.
Yeah, they loved
the two
to
of them
shop.
Loved to shop.
They had
yeah.
never been rifle shopping before, though. So, but they said, "You must take us downtown. We have to get a rifle." And they did. My grandmother wrote home, "We bought a rifle and 1,000 rounds of shot. I could barely lift the thing. What will I do in Calcutta?"
So what do you think ultimately was the biggest challenge they faced, Dorothy?
I think the biggest challenge was probably just persevering. I think it was so, you know, to get up every morning at 5:30, it was dark outside, the water in their pitcher had frozen overnight, the snow had blown in on their covers through the logs, they never missed a day of school. They just got up, you know, brushed themselves off, layered on their clothes, and then they were led to school by Lewis Harrison, and then they had to face all these challenges in the classroom. And that was a really, really rough time. But again, they realized they had been looking for some major challenge. They just hadn't known what it was.
You know, I got the sense reading this book that maybe in a small way you would have liked to have lived back then, even for a day or two, just to get a sense of what that whole world was like.
Oh, I have to say, I lived this whole experience vicariously. Mm-hmm. I thought it sounded so fabulous. And I, you know, again, to the question earlier, I feel that our children are not given challenges like this. We mostly aren't given challenges like this. And you don't know what you're capable of doing until you're faced with some of this stuff. And Roz wrote at one point, "I can't believe this classroom is ours to command." And I thought that was so moving from this woman who had just been so sheltered for all of those years. And suddenly she was coming into her own in a way she never would have anticipated.
Well, it's just an amazing book. Again, it's titled Nothing Daunted, The Unexpected Education of Two Society Girls in the West. And the book is exactly what the title describes. Dorothy Wickenden's been our guest. Again, you can see her tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the plaza. To reserve a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. I sure enjoyed having you.
Enjoyed being here. Thank you
All
so much.
All the best, Dorothy.